people rely on the police to keep them safe. That's the problem. Police only arrive after the crime has taken place. That's like trapping the fox as he's coming out of the hen house. If a man really wants to protect what's his, he has to do it for himself.
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast, where we have your deepest wishes fulfilled. No?
No, pushing it, Jay. Pushing it. Yeah, pushing it a little bit. The title of this is a bit of a non sequitur, to be honest with you.
I tried. Yeah.
I'm not sure the title is actually accurate for either of these movies.
Well, I mean, that was the name of Brian Garfield's novel, so...
It was, yeah.
We're talking about Death Wish today. Death Wish... 1974, classic Charles Bronson action thriller?
Action drama, I'd say, because there's not a lot of action in there, but there is a lot of drama. Not good drama, but drama.
Dramatic thriller.
Yeah, dramatic thriller.
Let's call it dramatic thriller. And of course, the 2018 remake starring Bruce Willis and directed by Eli Roth.
Yes.
And I'll have to give... reluctantly, I really like Eli Roth as like... a film aficionado. I could listen to him talk about film all day long.
He knows his shit.
Not too crazy about his movies most of the time, but I think I kind of like this. I mean, neither one of these movies are great in my mind.
No, I would agree with you 100%
okay.
on that.
Yeah, but I think they're fairly on even keel, and Eli Roth tried to give the character of Kersey a little more depth.
He fixed some of the holes from the original.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, those holes are probably, I would suspect, are in the novel as well. I haven't read the novel, but I think that the original movie is a little more true to what Garfield wrote. A little. There's some controversy about the way that the movie kind of glorified vigilantism versus the novel, which indicated that it was not a good thing.
Right? Yeah.
And I disagree with that to a certain extent, but we'll get into that.
Yeah, we'll definitely get into that. You know, I've always kind of treated Death Wish... as something that is actually more in the horror genre than the action genre, if that makes any sense, because he's essentially a slasher, but he's killing bad guys. So suddenly it changes, you know, instead of having a machete, he's got a gun. I mean, he's literally stalking people to kill them.
Well, he's baiting them. I don't know if he's stalking them.
He's definitely baiting them.
He's definitely baiting them, yes.
And I've seen documentaries use Death Wish... and these are horror documentaries using Death Wish in some of their clips. And I'm like, okay, I kind of see it. And, I mean, the original one also takes a lot from that vigilante justice, that Old West type of feel. And they certainly use that metaphor.
Yeah, they reference it.
And Amy Charles Bronson comes from those type of movies as well. He did a lot of spaghetti westerns and even earlier westerns before he went into the Italian cinema.
Yes. Yeah, he's... very experienced in that.
We'll get to talk about that next week.
Yes, we do. Yeah, no, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I've never been a fan of Bronson. I find him to be a very rigid actor. And I would even question the acting part of it.
It is funny to me as well, because growing up, you know, the tough guys was John Wayne from the Westerns and Clint Eastwood. I mean, from that era particularly. Yeah. I mean, it's a little before my time, but... I was very aware of Death Wish. My dad really liked Charles Bronson. I'm like, he just looks like a middle-aged school teacher.
Yeah.
He doesn't. But, I mean, initially this movie was going to, if it had gone with the original director, would have starred Jack Lemmon. So, as an everyman. But the novel describes him more as an everyman. Yeah. So, in hindsight, I do get a little of the tough guy vibe. I mean, he's got that penetrating Old West stare that guys in the sun had squint.
he does to a certain extent. It was really hard to buy him as an architect. I think he did.
Hey, it was supposed to be an accountant.
Yeah. Well, and they changed it again in the remake, too. Yeah. Him being an architect was a device to get him to Arizona and set up some of the story as it comes back and how he gets the gun that he uses as...
And the inspiration.
And the inspiration, absolutely. So I see how they did that and why they did it. It worked. Mm-hmm. It actually works fairly well.
Mm-hmm.
He's just so hard to buy as meek, but he did a pretty decent job.
And yeah, and I think that tough guy reputation had already been established through prior to Death Wish, although Death Wish is certainly his breakout movie as a lead actor. Yeah. But which is ironic that he'd been doing it for so long.
Well, yeah, Shadow's Land and Mechanic, which we've talked about.
Yes, we have. Thinking somebody like Jack Lemmon in that role, it's hard to see, but...
I think I probably would have enjoyed it more, though.
I was reading Charles Bronson was initially considered for Die Hard. I mean, he would have been in his 60s by then. But it's ironic that Bruce Willis... wound up
with that role and then remaking
and remaking this movie.
Yeah. So. There's an irony there. Yeah, I like it. I like it. Yeah. No, I genuinely do like it. Yeah, and that's the thing is, I mean, Bronson was already reasonably old at this point. He was in his 50s when he made this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Bruce is in his 60s, but...
Yeah, exactly. Bruce, he's starting to look a little grandfather-y to me.
Yeah, and he was really hard to buy as the pacifist guy. Right, just because he looks tough.
Well, I mean, and we have this preconception from the Die Hard movies as well. I think he manages to deliver a little more pathos in the role. Just he has more range, I think, than Charles Bronson.
Yeah,
does.
I mean, he's a more capable actor for sure.
Yeah, right?
I would have liked to see somebody maybe a little less associated with the action roles. Maybe they should have toupeed him or something to give him make him look less action guy, right? Because the shaved head. Definitely kind of adds to that action guy.
He's
look.
Been bald for a while, so yeah. I just don't think he can grow it anymore.
No, but they...
at least not up top.
Yeah,
so,
but they could have wigged him up like they did in Death Becomes Her, right?
Yeah.
They could have made him look more meek.
Well, right? Yeah, and I mean, right? He's in his 60s. He looks more like Elizabeth Shue's dad rather than...
Yeah, right, but if they'd have put a good wig on him, and like, I mean, Connery's done it, had done it for years, right?
Mm-hmm.
It just would have softened him up just a little bit and made his transition a lot more impactful, right? And the other problem too is having a big name actor, action actor like Bruce Willis in that role, you already know where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so even if you've never seen the original, you still see Bruce Willis and you know, okay, this is going into action, right? This is going to be an action movie because he's done so few that weren't. I mean, Sixth Sense is the only one I can think of off the top of my head where he did something dramatic.
Yeah, I mean, he's done dramas and he's done, like, comedies and action comedies we've seen, like, with Red and Hudson Hawk.
Yeah.
Although he always get that weird look on his face when he does comedies.
Yeah, kind of like Robert De Niro in our last comparison episode, because he has that look when he's doing comedies, too.
Yeah, exactly. There's just a certain look, like, I don't know, are you sucking on a sour? Did somebody stick something up your butt? That like person of the lips, like,
Yeah, it's, I don't know what it is.
That's uncomfortable.
Yeah, you know, that's one of his looks. He does it a lot, even in it. Actually, he does it in this movie at one point.
Oh, yeah, he did wind up doing it in, I don't know, it's his way of doing a lightening up a scene.
I'm not sure.
It's a weird look.
It is a weird look. It's a very distinctive Bruce Willis.
It's probably a holdover from Moonlighting, yeah. But I didn't really watch a lot of Moonlighting.
Yeah, but yeah, I think it's like one of these trademark look. I don't know what it is, but I enjoyed watching both of them. I don't think I've seen Death Wish since I was a kid.
You know what? I'd never seen either one of them. So, I mean, it's kind of nice going in clean because you don't have those preconceptions. And I'll talk to some of my friends and customers at work and they'll be like, oh, yeah, that remake sucked. And we always talk about nostalgia clouding people's judgment about films. So I got to go in clean. I mean, I had no preconceptions of Charles Bronson as a tough guy because I didn't really watch Charles Bronson movies as a kid. In fact, I didn't really start watching Charles Bronson until we started doing this podcast, really.
Magnificent Seven. Yeah.
And then eventually The Mechanic. So I've actually seen more Charles Bronson movies in the last 3 or 4 years than I probably did in my entire life.
Yeah, back when the video stores, I went through a brief Charles Bronson phase where I watched some of the stuff that he was well known for, like Shadow's Land and most of the Death Wish movies. I'd already seen the first one, so I watched some of the sequels, which get progressively worse.
I did wind up watching Death Wish 2 after I finished the first Death Wish, just like, let's see what the next one's like. Oh, it's pretty much the first one.
Yeah.
The first thing I could think about, and Liam Neeson was considered for the remake at one point, I'm like, well, he's already got three of these.
Yes.
He's a man with a certain set of skills, and shit keeps happening to him, and he keeps doing the same revenge plot. That's kind of what this is. I mean, it's a little different. Instead of people getting that he loves being taken, they're just straight up murdered.
Yes.
I mean, by the second one, it's like, okay, well, his daughter who went comatose and psycho in the first one gets impaled, and just to add insult to injury, his maid. I'm like, who's left by the... I mean, there are five of these fucking movies with Charles Bronson.
Well, then it starts to move into Equalizer territory.
Okay.
Yeah, he starts finding situations where he helps people out.
Okay.
If I recall correctly. I could be wrong. Feel free to correct us.
Yeah.
But if I remember correctly, yeah, he moves into that sort of... He doesn't go looking for them, but he finds them anyhow kind of thing.
If it had been Death Wish 6, it would have been like, oh, that's the first John Wick. It was like, I've already lost everything. All I have left is my dog.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and a lot of movies, you're right, owe a lot to the Death Wish movies in that sense.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. The every man who, well, actually, sorry, Liam Neeson and John Wick are these guys.
They're definitely not every man.
They're definitely not every man, that's right, but they're trying to be.
I also was thinking about, like, Falling Down. This is certainly, the theme of this is that guy who cuts you off on the light and you're just, that rage moment where you just want to kill that guy, or, you know, somebody snatched your purse or crashed into your car and did a hit and run. You just, like, that moment where you're like, I could just go out and kill that guy. This is the guy who got into that rage moment and never left.
That's exactly what it is, right? And Falling Down is a great example of that. Also my favorite Michael Douglas movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, there's so many gaps in the original. There are so many gaps in that original mm-hmm. movie that make it harder to watch than watching the remake. Even though the remake's not necessarily a superior film, one thing that was done right is they've filled in some of the holes and addressed... I personally enjoyed the fact that he never really did get the guys that...
In the original?
Family in the original.
Yeah, right? But at the same time, when I finished that, I didn't have any real sense of closure, per se.
Exactly.
But, I mean, how do you find these... anonymous guys, you weren't there, you didn't have like home security, and they didn't set up an evidence thing. So, you know, it does make a certain kind of sense. He's just out there randomly trying to get revenge and doesn't even know if he's going to find those guys or not. I don't know. It's just a case of blaming something that's happening in the city of New York.
Well, that's
as a whole.
That's where I would get back into how. This movie, they say it glorified vigilantism, and if it weren't for that final moment at the end of the movie, mm-hmm. I don't think it would have, because it had been considered a glorification of it. Because he's, and I think if Bronson had been a better actor, I think it would have carried through a little bit better as well, is I think that he's crazy. He's gone nuts. He doesn't care if he gets the guys that harmed his family. He just wants to relieve some of that pressure and some of that anger.
Yeah, there's so much boiling inside of him, and even after losing his wife and his daughter is in the hospital, just disconnected, he gets mugged himself, and it's just enough. Like, he's being victimized, and the whole city is, really. It's just being run rampant. I mean, in 1974, New York was the most violent city in America, which is why they switched it to Chicago in the remake, because New York wasn't anymore.
Yes, and that made sense. That was a logical change.
Yeah. It also works quite nicely with the original, where, you know, it's finally he leaves town and he goes to Chicago.
Yeah, I liked that, actually. I'm like, oh, how about that? He ends up in Chicago.
Yeah.
Right? And then you watch the remake and...
Yeah.
They're in Chicago.
Yeah.
Almost like a sequel.
And when he leaves town, that end scene is in New York.
Yeah. No, it all ties together so well, and I'm sure that was part of the thing as well. Let's take it to Chicago. The original movie ended there anyhow. Mm-hmm. So,
They were developing the movie in 2016, 2017, Chicago was the most violent city in America.
Yeah, no, and it makes sense. Like, the radio reports were really good at sort of communicating that to you.
Yeah, I actually appreciate the way Eli Roth set that up, actually.
Yeah, he did a good job of setting up a lot of things. Going back to Bronson and his sort of transition and how sort of he started doing this to relieve some of that pressure, right? There are some great scenes there where they showed his change in demeanor, right? Where he was happy after that first, after his first kill.
Well, you know, I mean, he had that makeshift blackjack, the quarters in the sock, right?
Which was very funny, actually.
It was funny, you know, he winds up successfully fighting off this mugger by clocking him with this makeshift blackjack, and then he's swinging around the apartment kind of all jazzed. Initially, he's kind of like, he's still shaken by the moment, but as he's kind of empowered by it as well. It's like, okay, I'm not helpless, and there's this successful thing, and he's flinging it around, and he accidentally hit something in his apartment and the whole thing shatters.
Yes.
Crap.
No, and that was actually very amusing. It was a nice moment of levity.
It was.
In the middle of which is essentially a very dark film all the way through.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what? Let's take a look at the trailer for the original 1974 Death Wish.
Enjoy a typical afternoon in New York City.
Who is it?
Grocery's man.
My name is Paul Kersey. How's my wife?
I'm sorry. She died a few minutes ago, Mr. Kersey.
Any chance of catching these men?
There's a chance, sure.
Just a chance.
I'd be less than honest if I gave you more hope, Mr. Kersey.
This is Paul Kersey. This is the story of a man who decided to clean up the most violent town in the world.
I said, turn around. Hand me the money.
He begins where all the super cops leave off.
Mugging has gone down by how much, sir?
$9.50 a week to $4.70, you reported last week.
You understand not too many people know that.
And you want to keep it that way, huh?
Oh, no, we have to keep it that way, Inspector. This whole city would explode.
And if this person is listening to my voice, I urge him in the name of law and order to desist from this one-man crusade and turn himself into the police.
Let's see the money, man.
Call him a mad vigilante. Call him a hero. Either way, he's always on target.
We want you to get out of New York permanently.
Never make a death wish, because a death wish always comes true, and you get to love it.
All right, that was Death Wish from 1974. Written and directed, at least co-written and directed, by Michael Winner, who would go on to direct the next two Death Wish movies, The Sentinel, The Big Sleep, and of course, we talked about him in episode 128.
The Mechanic.
Based on the novel by Brian Garfield, the screenplay was written by Wendell Mays, and we've talked about him before as well in episode 69.
Poseidon
Adventure, yeah. Absolutely. And there's an uncredited writing credit to Gerald Wilson as well. Movie was budgeted at $3 million and went on to gross $22 million. So quite successful for its low-budget kind of action fare. And it was, I think, put out by Dino De Laurentiis, who had picked it up in Turnaround. This movie was only made 2 years after the novel, but it did wind up going in turnaround when I think United Artists was having some trouble getting it off the ground. So went in and turned around. Dino De Laurentiis picked it up and then eventually sold it to the Cannon Group, who milks things to death.
Yes.
Of course, starring Charles Bronson, and we talked about him again in episode 128, Mechanic, and episode 105, Magnificent Seven. Also starring Hope Lang as Joanna Kersey, and she's from Blue Velvet, and most of our audience being horror watchers would recognize her from Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2. Vincent Gardenia was Frank Ochoa, the detective in this movie. We've actually mentioned him before in episode 55.
Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh, Sam, you make me so proud of you doing your homework.
I did.
Stephen Keats plays Jack Toby. He's in movies like Silent Rage and Black Sunday. William Redfield is also in this movie, and we talked about him in episode 54.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah, we actually remade One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
And yeah, never
that episode goes cuckoo itself.
Yes, yeah, it really does.
So go check that out. And he's also in another movie I would like to do at some point called Fantastic Voyage. It's great. Stuart Margolin. Most people would recognize him from The Rockford Files. Stephen Elliott is the police commissioner in this. He's in Arthur's 1 and 2 and Beverly Hills Cop. I mentioned that because I do want to tackle Arthur at some point as well. Kathleen Tolan, Jack Wallace, Fred J. Scully, all in this movie. There's some notable cameos in here one in particular was in two other episodes we've done, episode 101 The Fly and episode 113 Transylvania 65,000. His name is
Jeff Goldblum in his very first screen appearance.
Absolutely. I thought that was pretty cool. He's not so cool because he winds up being one of the freaks at the beginning of the movie. Freak number one.
And you see his bare ass, which was not at all appealing. And I have to say that scene is incredibly graphic for its time, I was really uncomfortable watching it.
Mm-hmm.
Right, certainly a lot more than I was in the remake.
I mean, I think I've seen more graphic rape scenes on film, but in 1974 that would have been pretty shocking the way they handled that. And it's even considering how much we love Jeff Goldblum these days, it's that much more unsettling.
Yeah, and I think that's part of why it was so unsettling, because
Jeff Goldblum, want to see him that way.
No, he typically plays a nice guy. I mean, even in The Fly, he's a nice guy who goes bad.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was just incredibly uncomfortable.
It was, yeah. Which is what that scene
it achieved its goal, for sure.
Absolutely. Christopher Guest, also in this movie.
Oh, I missed that one.
Yeah. He plays a patrolman, Patrolman Riley, fairly late in the movie. He does get lines, and of course, you know, this is Spinal Tap. Come on, it's Christopher Guest. And lots of voice work. And Olympia Dukakis is also in this as well, and she's been in some big, big stuff.
Yes,
Moonstruck and Steel Magnolias.
Yeah. And she gets some dialogue in this as well. She plays. Yeah. She's in one of the bullpen scenes and delivers an update.
Yeah, if you actually go through the IMDb of most of the Death Wishes, at least the first three, there's like, these are the start of career type movies.
Yeah.
And you'll see like other people that you will totally recognize in some minor roles. Yeah. It's
They all have to start somewhere, right?
That's right. Yeah. And it's kind of cool to see that the birth of a career in some of these places.
Yeah, just like we did with Chud. We saw John Goodman in his early career. And we get a few of those.
Yeah, so Death Wish is kind of a little minor gold mine of these type of appearances. I mean, Olivia Dukakis, I think, was well established at this point, but Christopher Guest and Jeff Goldblum were
starting out. You forget how far back Jeff Goldblum's career goes.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like 1974. I mean, he was probably only in his late teens, early 20s when he started there, but again, he's so distinctive. As soon as I saw him, I'm like, hey, that's Jeff Goldblum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen him that young. So it was quite interesting to see how far they stretch back.
But you watch that performance of the brief amount of time he gets on screen, and you can see why his career has gone so well.
Yeah,
right? Because he brings something to every performance.
Yeah.
Right? And he still had that unique smarminess that only Jeff Goldblum can deliver.
Yeah, they don't give him a lot of lines, but because it's all a lot of hooting and hollering and harassing.
Yeah, but yeah, he's so good at facial expressions and that grin he gets, and he manages to, when he needs to, he can make it evil. Mm-hmm. Right? And he was. This character was evil. He was somebody who had no moral compunctions whatsoever. He just wanted what he wanted.
Yeah, exactly. This small group finds out where the Kerseys live, and they're supposed to be out that night, and they aren't. Actually, no, that's in the remake. They're supposed to be out that night.
That's right. It's in the remake. That yeah. And this one, they deliberately stalked them.
Yeah, they just got stalked, yeah.
Because they got the grocery tag and used it to get the address and followed.
Yeah, and they pulled something similar in the remake with the car valet taking the information from, I think, was that a Nonstar thing or something?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and he took a photo with his smartphone.
Yeah, to get their address. And then,
I overheard that they were going to be out later that evening for his birthday, Paul's birthday. And then, of course, that gets canceled because he has to go in to
cover a sick co-worker's shift. Yeah,
yeah, because he's a surgeon. Yeah.
He's an ER doctor.
Yeah.
So, which plays well later on in the film.
Yeah, well, that's actually a good role switch because he can really see the impact that this violence in the city is happening on regular people, not just because he's already gone through his own trauma, but especially when that kid comes in and has been shot in the leg as an example.
Yeah,
because he's not working for this drug dealer in this neighborhood.
Yeah, he's being punished for being a good kid.
Yeah.
Right. It works. I would have to say the remake is actually slightly superior because it fills, like I keep saying, fills in some holes, but it also really develops the story a little bit better, right? With little things like that, like just little itty bitty things, and he uses his position as a doctor to target specific types of criminals and people he knows are bad people, but it also sets up the opportunity for him to get his weapon.
Yeah, yeah, I certainly liked it when he sees the commercial for that gun store with the hot blonde, which was actually one of Eli Roth's regulars. She was in Green Inferno. And he actually goes in, asks some questions, and notices, well, shit, if I'm going to grab a gun that's registered and they see me on camera, this is going to be a pretty short revenge story.
Yes.
So he backs off, but luckily a wounded gang member comes in and a gun falls off him when he's being brought into ER, and he hides it and takes that gun.
Yeah. And I love the scenes where he's learning how to shoot. Mm-hmm. The first time he fires that shot in the ricochet, it was a brief moment, but I like the way it sort of shows his inexperience. Mm-hmm. I think that in the original, the way they kind of wrote in that he did know how to use guns,
there
and
is a
crack
little
shot,
bit
of, it felt
there's too much convenience in his character in the original. Even I kind of had a bit of an eye roll, but it was the 70s. They're just trying to move things along. But he was a conscientious objector in the Korean War.
Yeah.
So he would have gone through the training. Well, actually, he probably wouldn't have. But so he actually went through the war without handling a gun. But he grew up on like a farm. And his dad was a big hunter. So he already had the skills as far as shooting. He just hadn't handled guns in all that
40
time.
Years.
In 40 years. But he still, the skill was still there. And didn't really have to be developed. I love that he's like looking at YouTube videos in the remake, looking how to clean the gun and maintain it.
Oh yeah, and where he learns how to destroy the hard drive. Like I like the way that it shows you
the good and bad of YouTube.
Yes, it really does.
Freaking YouTube.
But yeah, it also modernizes it really, really well.
Yeah,
like it shows his inexperience and how he becomes more experienced with what he's doing. And that first scene where it's literally, for lack of a better way of putting it, a crime of opportunity, where he stumbles into a carjacking.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not a crack shot. He's not killing him with one shot like he was in the original. He makes mistakes. Mm-hmm. Right? Like at his very first one out, he makes mistakes, which is what you would expect.
Yeah.
Right? Is that he would make a mistake and where the slide racks back and cuts his hand.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and it plays throughout the movie, which again, also credit to the writing to tie all these things in to give you some consistency through the whole story.
Yeah, and it's like in the original, the detective Frank, he comes to conclusions that kind of like make me question where he's getting his ideas from. Okay, yeah, there's lots of violence, so he's looking, he's figuring this vigilante probably lost somebody recently. I mean, maybe not that much of a stretch, but trying to work through that many files in a violent city is probably next to impossible. And then he's like, we're probably looking at a war vet. So look at the Vietnam and Korean wars. Again, not sure where he came to that conclusion, but
And this goes to some of those gaps in the writing, because there were a lot of leaps of logic throughout the whole movie. There are these leaps of logic.
Whereas at least the detective in the remake had some stuff to work with. There was somebody had filmed with their smartphone, and they could see this guy was inexperienced, didn't get his face, but knew he was inexperienced, and then there was a wound on his hand, so they knew there was something to look towards, and knew he was left-handed.
Yes, and I like the way that he had the hood up, and they nicknamed him the Grim Reaper. Mm-hmm. Like, it was a sort of a nice affectation. I mean, it wasn't necessary, but it did help feed the story a little bit.
Yeah, well, Grim Reaper, first hoodie goth.
Yeah, yeah. The more I think about the original, because the detective in the original, holy overacting, it was not good. Every time he's on the screen, I'm like, okay, how bad is it going to be? Oh, it's bad as I thought.
Makes you feel better. They kill him off in the second one for no real reasons. They just threw him in there. It wasn't even, let's fly across country because this guy sounds like the guy from New York. I'm like, why would you go? It's their problem. Just send him the fucking file.
Yeah.
Could have handled that with a phone call, and then you could have been in the third one.
Exactly. One thing about both movies, and the one thing I like better in the original is the way that the mayor and the chief are saying, "Don't catch him; you'll make him a martyr."
Yeah, there's
they want
like
him to stop.
Yeah, they want him to stop. It's because the vigilante's getting actual support. Problem is, he's also inspiring other people to do so, and they're getting hurt trying to emulate it. So they kind of want that example to stop, but arresting him wouldn't be great either because it puts the police in a negative light and the city itself with this guy who's actually affecting the crime rate.
Yes.
In a positive way.
Yeah. He's bringing it down. These criminals are scared to be on the street because they don't know if they're going to be next.
Exactly. Right?
And I think that's part of why they thought it was glorifying vigilantism, because it showed that it had a positive effect on the crime rate, but it didn't because he's contributing to the crime rate.
Yeah, I mean, right. what he's doing is a crime as well.
Yeah, there's that juxtaposition there is well, yes, you're...
Yeah, there's less muggings, but more murder.
Yeah. Right, and exactly. Your violent crime rate might drop down in the sense of muggings, but you still have more dead people.
But it's dead people that a lot of people aren't going to miss.
Well, and that's the thing, and that's the question about both these movies is do the ends justify the means, right?
And maybe somebody can tell me, because I've only watched a couple of these Death Wish movies. Does he ever catch up with any of the original freaks from the original film? Because I don't think he does.
I don't think he does.
It would have been nice closure to at least get one of them, but...
Well, and that's what that's one of the things I actually liked about the original, is the fact that there's no sense of closure.
Right? Yeah.
Because, I mean, his daughter's still in a coma.
She wasn't in the original. She wasn't in a coma. She
was mad,
just detached from the world.
Yeah, she was so traumatized that she was institutionalized. That's right. Yeah.
Exactly. She was institutionalized, and she was a little more functional by the second one, but because you have a similar invasion trauma, she tries to escape and then jumps out of a window and then get impaled on a big fence.
Creative.
So that was it for her. So same shit twice.
Is that useless sack of shit son-in-law in the second one?
No,
he just disappears.
He just disappears.
Thank God, he was so annoying. And I'm glad they did away with that character in the remake, because he serves no purpose whatsoever in the original.
No.
He took up screen time that could have been used to tell the story better.
Yeah, they made it Frank's brother, and this is like the uncle to to Paul's daughter.
Yeah, and he served his purpose
was
far better.
Yeah.
Far, D'Onofrio's character was so much stronger and actually helped bring the story along instead of hindering it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it gave a deflection, at least to the detectives, because here's a guy who had a bit of a reputation. We see he's a little bit Weasley at the beginning. I don't know about Weasley, but hasn't got his life together. He's borrowing money from Paul, and this seems to be something they've established, that it's something that's a fairly regular occurrence.
Well, there's even a joke about it.
Yeah.
Just ask my brother. I never pay for anything.
Yeah, and the cops seem to be aware of this guy. Yeah. To some degree. I'm guessing it was just warnings and, hey, you're running with the wrong people type of thing. But he became a person of interest because he's the uncle. he's related to,
he's affected,
to Paul.
He's affected by this tragedy.
Yeah.
And seems to
well.
Have the personality type to do that type of thing.
Yeah, so they don't look to Paul. They look to his brother Frank instead, which ironically is the tip-off to Frank that it's his brother.
Yeah. Yeah, because he puts together the cuts because they ask him to see his hand because they're looking for an injury
on
his hand.
And he'd already seen it prior in the day when he visited his brother to pay him back because he got his shit together.
There's
I like that character.
He brings those moments of levity to the film. D'Onofrio's so good at that.
Yeah, but he's also the conscience of the film. Like, he convinces his brother to stop.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
He's like, I've already lost his wife. Was he? Maybe he's the brother of the wife. No, he had the same last name.
Yeah,
so.
It's Paul and...
Yeah, but, you know, he's already lost... These are his family to him, so he's already lost one member of the family and one's in a coma. He even says it, I don't want to lose you as well.
Exactly, and he's finally getting his stuff together. And there's a point there, because the cops approach him in a batting cage where he's swinging away, and they don't reference it anywhere else in the film, but there's like he was a prospect for the majors. They knew him that way as well, as he was a talented athlete, and something had happened and they don't explain it, and I wish they had. Right, it would have given his character just that smidge more depth that I would have liked to have seen, that would kind of explain why he's kind of aimless and relies on his brother as much as he does.
Yeah. Now, the inspiration for the vigilantism is kind of different in both films. Like, the first film is very much inspired. I mean, yes, he's kind of hitting the streets and trying to fight back, but when he's sent to Arizona on a research mission because he's developing a property, he's an architect, right? So he's looking at this land and trying to develop it for this buyer. The buyer takes him kind of on a tour of this fake old West town. And I've been to something like this where they do
the reenactments
and stuff. And this really inspires Kersey. He's like, okay, the old West thing really speaks to him.
Yeah, and it reinforces some of the things that Margolin's character was saying right, about how things are different in Arizona.
Yeah.
Right? And how the best way to protect yourself, to stay safe, is to protect yourself.
And, you know, Paul to his gun club, and they fire off a few rounds, and that's where we learn that Paul's a natural. Yeah. He's really actually good at this, and the development guy, he gifts a gun to Paul.
To Paul, to thank him for seeing his vision and making it a reality kind of thing. And that part of the story was actually really well done. I actually enjoyed that quite a bit, because it does, again, it shows his progression moving towards what he's about to do. Mm-hmm. But for such a short movie, a lot of that time is consumed by all this setup.
Yeah, there's a lot of setup, and I think that's okay, because you get to see that slow climb towards where he winds up being before he starts stalking the streets.
Yes. And it works to good effect. There was something that Val said when we were watching it, and for the life of me, I cannot remember whereabouts it was, but there was... When he goes to Tucson, she was really mad because there was some stuff happening in New York that just kind of disappeared. They never talked about it again, never referenced it. And for me, I cannot remember what it was that bugged her so much, but she was mad.
Sounds like Val.
Yeah. She's like, what happened to this? What happened to this? What happened to this? And that's... There's a lot of what happened to this in the original movie.
There is a lot of, like... Okay, here's your motivation. Now let's sweep it away. We need to get it out of the way so we can get to him going to killing muggers.
Yeah.
And it does. It just kind of pushes it aside.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that just kind of...
It's like, okay, well, we need to get his daughter out of here and keep him from having to keep going back to the hospital over and over and over again. So she gets sent to the nuns and where they can take care of her so he can focus on what he's doing on the streets.
It is a little bit frustrating because there's all these loose ends that never get tied off in the original. And Roth's version does a great job tying off all the loose ends.
Yeah, I think he does. Now, his motivation's quite different in the...
I would say quite different, but it is definitely different. His inspiration is different.
I can't even remember what his inspiration was now that I'm thinking about it.
His inspiration was when he gets that one moment where he stands up and to help that lady of the night or whatever she was, who was getting roughed up by the two toughs, and he stands up to them.
And he gets his ass kicked.
And he gets roughed up. Yeah. And then he sees the video, or the commercial for the guns after that. And
what I thought. I was like, was it just the commercial?
Yeah. No, it was a combination of the two things. It was getting roughed up And then...
Because he tried to do something and was unsuccessful doing it and realized that he needed an equalizer.
Yes. All right. Because he had this realization that he doesn't want to be the person who ignores the problems anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then the gun commercial motivates him to go to the gun store.
Mm-hmm.
And then he has that realization as well, this isn't going to work because I'll have a registered gun. They've got me on camera.
Most of the muggers on the original film are they all have like these tiny little switchblades.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, oh, that's a little uneven.
But it's also indicative of the time because guns were really hard. The illegal gun market wasn't the same as it is now.
No. No, it does make sense there'd be more guns in the modern film for sure.
Yeah, and there certainly are.
There definitely are. Right. Yeah, you got that ending where it was very much that True Grit. Like, there's a guy, he's going to kill him, but he's in a prone position. He's like, yeah, put it in your hand. Like, pick up the gun.
Yeah. Yeah, it's...
But he succumbs to his own wounds before he gets to shoot him.
Yes. The motivation is similar, right? It's a part of the healing process, trying to bring an end to the crime that's affected his family.
We try to see the grief in the original, but it's fairly short. I think Bruce Willis delivers that better.
Well, and there's these scenes that were added with the therapist, which helps move the story along in terms of his and progression and how what he's doing is affecting him in a positive way.
Yeah, yeah. The therapist at some point says, "Hey, you're looking better. You seem happier."
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, I am. We'll keep doing what you're doing, which is kind of funny
because,
he's out there murdering muggers. And he's like, okay, yeah I will.
Yeah, but in the remake, there's a lot fewer randoms. The first one is one of those things where he sees a crime being committed and steps in. Actually, the first two, the first one was where he gets beat up and then the one with the carjacking. And again, I love the fact that he wasn't a crack shot and that he makes mistakes and he gets caught on film.
Yeah.
Right? Which would make sense in our day and age is somebody has shots.
A lot more CCTV, a lot more people with camera phones. And
yeah, and there's a great line there where she says, oh, I thought of that to social media hours ago.
Yeah, the cop asks, no, don't do it. Yeah. It's like, oh, it's already up there.
Yeah.
It's gone viral.
Yeah, too late. yeah, you need to be more on top of it. But again, it just helps set up the story and it makes the detective's progression through the story more feasible and realistic, right? He's got clues that have been left. Right? In the original, there are clues. There's the grocery bag that gets left behind on the train is sort of their first real clue.
Yeah.
And they tie that together really well in the original.
Yeah, because it tracks back to the grocery store that we...
That was at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, that we see the wife, and that's how the thugs... found the place in the first place was off of the delivery receipt.
That's right. So it ties back very nicely.
Yeah.
Right. And it's one of the things that I thought was really well done is given the investigative techniques of 1974 versus 2018.
Yeah.
Right. Those are the types of clues that they would need.
Yeah. And then after Detective Frank gets the dictate, you know, just scare him off. And he's making these random phone calls and say, hey, the police are on to you. You need to let this go.
Yeah, no, and I liked that part of it.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it because it...
Things start to make a little more sense by that point. And I did like... Because even I was like watching the movie, I was like, oh, he left his groceries behind. Are they going to pick up on that? Because, you know, you get frustrated with some of the holes in the film. Yeah. And then like, yes, they picked up on that. Good.
Yeah, yeah, because that's really the only tie they have to Paul is that grocery bag.
Yeah, and that ties it back to a neighborhood, and that narrows down the search, and they can go, hey, okay, who are the victims of crime in this neighborhood? And they're able to piece it together, because you would figure somebody who would do this would probably be a victim of some sort of tragedy, because they're only going after the bad guys.
Yeah.
And it's a very specific type of criminal as well.
But they never have enough evidence to make an arrest.
No.
Right? It's just enough to sort of, this is the guy we want to look at. They're monitoring him, but he still manages
before
to...
before gun registration or whatever, so they can't even track that the bullets.
Well,
they know what type of gun it is.
They do, yeah. But really, they only finally get him when they find him shot.
Yeah.
At a botched stalking.
Yeah.
Right? Or baiting, where he just... things don't go right and he gets shot. He ends up getting shot.
Yeah.
Right? And in the remake, he gets shot as well, but it's handled differently.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Where it's...
It kind of ends where it begins.
Yeah.
Because the original home invasion guys that did this crime Frank's slowly tracking them down through some evidence he's not sharing with the police.
Yes.
Whether it be finding one of his rings. Initially, what sparks it all off was that thug that gets brought in that has his watch.
Yes.
On around his wrist, and it's the valet.
Yes, and then he starts making the connections.
Yeah, and then he starts making the connections and then systematically taking them down. Yeah. Some of it goes well, some of it doesn't, but traps are set to take Frank out, and they're fairly clever ones.
Yes.
Because Frank, I keep saying Frank, I'm sorry, Paul. And I like the one where they've tried to set up a meeting, and then the phone rings in the nightclub, and they open the door. He shoots through the door, and nobody's there. It's just the phone. And
yeah,
there's a few setups like that that are actually quite good.
Well, yeah, I like the fact that
they're clever anyway. I don't know if they're good.
They're clever, and it's to show that the leader of this gang he thinks things through, and he's smart. What happened with Paul's family was not intentional. It wasn't intended as a home invasion. It was intended as a burglary.
Yeah, really, there was only one guy that fucked everything up.
Yeah, the creepy guy who got all rapey.
Yeah. All right, well, we've set that up a lot, so let's run the trailer for the 2018.
Have I told you I love you?
Yes, Dad, you've told me like a billion times. Honey? Can you please come down here?
Doc, something has happened. You can't go in there.
Dad, where's Mom?
I love my family. I failed to protect them.
I'm sorry, Dr. Kersey, nothing yet.
So there's nothing that I can do? Is that what you're saying?
You can have faith.
How'd faith work out for them?
If a man really wants to protect what's his, he has to do it for himself.
The men who did it are out there. I'm gonna hunt them down. One by one.
I had homies in the mountains, brave, doing gun trades out of the dark.
We're close, pal.
You're Joey, right?
Yeah.
Who killed my wife? Who else was there?
I don't know anything else.
You're not gonna kill me.
No.
Jack is.
Can't deny me now.
You got caught in some crossfire?
Yeah. You said next time an ink will be my leg.
You are gonna be all right, I promise. On the mission, no other way they can stop
me now. You're not a cop!
Somebody has to do it!
Everybody's watching this viral video of this dude right for taking the law into his own hands.
Hey! Is he a hero?
He saved my life.
Or is it wrong?
You're cocked, locked, and ready to rock.
I'll say, someone took my wife. Everyone involved is going to pay.
You look much better getting out socializing.
Not so much.
Well, whatever you're doing, keep it up.
Okay, I will.
All right, Death Wish 2018, directed by Eli Roth, most notable for his horror films.
I mean, yeah, he's...
Cabin Fever.
Yeah, he's really the sort of father of the torture porn stuff, right?
Yeah. And there is definitely some torture stuff in this one as well.
Just that one scene, but it was cringy.
He didn't coin it, but torture porn was coined because of things like Hostel. And then I saw in reference to this movie the use of the words revenge porn, like it's a new thing. It's not.
It's not. No.
This movie's screenplay was by Joe Carnahan, who wrote the A-Team film, Smoking Aces, and will be writing the screenplay for Bad Boys for Life in 2020.
Hmm.
Yeah. This movie's budget was $30 million.
That was almost all Bruce Willis's salary.
I'm sure. The gross was roughly 34 million in the U.S. and about 48.5 worldwide.
So another Bruce Willis bomb.
Yeah, it didn't do so well. But yes, of course, starring Bruce Willis as Paul Kersey, Vincent D'Onofrio. We've talked about him before in episode 105, which was
Magnificent Seven. We already talked about that because that was another nice tie-in there, isn't there?
Exactly. And wasn't he in Strange Days as well?
No, that was what's his nuts? Oh, I can't remember his name now. I know who you're thinking of, but yeah, no, he.
I got something written down here for, but I'm like, it's over his name, and I'm like, I don't think he was he?
No, the only connection I found was Magnificent Seven.
Okay, well, check out episode 119 anyway. Strange Days was awesome.
Yes, it was.
Elizabeth Shue, we've talked about in episode 148, Piranha.
Yeah,
Piranha remains one of our more popular episodes. She wasn't that good in this movie, was she?
No, you know, while we were watching the trailer, I'm like, I have to mention the fact that Shue phoned in this performance. She doesn't, especially during the invasion, she was just awful. I'm like, oh, really?
Yeah.
You're better than this. I know you're better than this. And you want to talk about something popping you out of a film? That was definitely one of those moments.
Yeah. Camilla Morrone, was actually a newcomer. I think this is her first feature. And Eli Roth just kind of saw her somewhere and like, oh yeah, you're going to be my daughter, my Jordan here for Paul. Actually, I think she makes a pretty good film debut here.
She's really solid.
Yeah,
I like the fact they went younger, mm-hmm. even though the age difference between Shue and Willis is pretty unbelievable.
I agree.
But yeah, they allowed them to get rid of the annoying son-in-law.
Yeah. Dean Norris is the detective in this one. Dean Norris, a lot of people remember him. Most audiences probably know him now from Breaking Bad, but we talked about him way back in episode 84.
Total Recall. And he was in the original, not the remake.
That's right. So he's been around for a while. And it was really nice to see. It's very similar to his Breaking Bad role.
Yeah, he plays the tough but kind cop.
Yeah. Bo Knapp is Knox. He's in Super 8 and No One Lives. We talked about No One Lives briefly in one of our 31 Days of Horror episode.
Yeah, we both watched that one.
That's right. Kimberly Elise is Dean Norris's partner, Lenore, and you can see her in the remake of The Manchurian Candidate. Someday we'll cover that. Yeah. Len Carrillo was in Spotlight. Jack Kessie, he's one of the thugs named Fish. You've seen him in Deadpool 2.
Yes. He's got quite a few credits under his belt. And mostly in supporting roles, but
yeah.
You know what? If you're working, you're working.
Yeah, and like he's getting decent on-screen roles. So Ronnie Jean Blevins, I talked about him a little bit in another 31 Days of Horror episode about a movie called Avenged, also aka Savaged.
We both watched that one too.
Yeah, quite love that movie, so thought I'd mention it. Kirby Bliss Blanton was Bethany. She was the gun store owner.
Yeah.
And she's in another Eli Roth movie called Green Inferno. And I just want to point out there's a nice cameo of Stephen McHattie in here as the chief of detectives. I've mentioned Pontypool several times on the show, as well as Hellmouth, and you can see him in Watchmen as well. And yeah, we mainly just talked about him in the 31 Days of Horror episodes, but Canadian treasure Stephen McHattie.
Yes, and I kind of got the feeling that this was filmed in Canada. I didn't check, but a lot of the actors in this have a lot of Canadian credits.
Yeah, I think it was probably Vancouver or Toronto. Yeah. It looked more of a Toronto cast.
Yeah, I didn't do my due diligence and follow up to see if it was, but it had that feel.
I'll be honest, I didn't either. But even if it wasn't, like Chicago's not that far away from Toronto, so
fair enough. Yeah, but yeah, definitely a great representation of Canadian cast in there.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Let's talk about ratings for a second here, because the IMDb rating for the original is a solid 7.0 out of 10. And the Rotten Tomatoes score is fairly even at 65% critic score and a 68% audience score.
Those feel about right to me, because there's lots to like about it, but it isn't. Doesn't deserve the reverence it gets either, though.
Yeah, I think, again, that's nostalgia more than anything else, and people's love for Charles Bronson. I don't think it ages particularly well, but it was always going to be a controversial film to begin with. It was then, it is still now.
Yes.
Eli Roth had to delay this because of a school shooting. So, you know, something that glorifies vigilantism or gun violence. they were careful.
Yeah.
And I think it did get buried in its release because of the ongoing gun violence and just in general in the world
and
sensitivity to it.
I think that might be one of the reasons it failed, because it's not a bad film. It's not a great film, but it's not a bad film.
Well, let's see. IMDb's not quite as strong as the original one. 6.4 out of 10. Still feels like it's in the pocket.
Yeah.
Rotten Tomatoes, though. Critics score was 17%.
They're wrong.
The audience liked it a lot more at 73%, so the audience actually liked it more than the original. But the critics sure didn't.
Well, and I can see why the critics wouldn't have. Even though Roth filled in a lot of the story and made sure there are no loose ends, it certainly glorifies the violence and the vigilantism a lot more than the original.
Yeah, there's definitely some of that more grosser horror stuff that you would see in a Eli Roth horror movie, especially when the car falls on that guy's head and when Paul pulls out that jack.
Yes.
I was like, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. But yeah, and it lost the message. Like, it completely limited it. Like, the message that was in the original, while it wasn't as strong as it could have been, was there.
Yeah.
Whereas this one, it's just a straight-up action flick.
Well, you know, this one, I'd also at least defend the critics somewhat. Like, whereas the original has those plot holes and just convenience, so does the Eli Roth's. I mean, there are times when he's getting into it with the thug and probably should have died, but there's a convenient dart laying there or a bowling ball falling down. It really does feel like Final Destination looking out for him sometimes.
And there are a couple, that scene in particular, that really does feel that way.
There's just happenstance kind of gets him out of it a couple of times. And it does feel awfully convenient at times.
Yeah, but there's some luck feeding him there, yeah.
Yeah, so does the original. It certainly has those, that convenience sake, just in a different way. It doesn't feel as Final Destination, but
no, and you're right. That's the only spot where I really know where it's really noticeable.
Yeah.
But it is really noticeable there. Right? Because when the bowling ball fell, especially, I'm like, you got to be fucking kidding me.
Yeah.
Like, really?
Can we just mention a second when he walks into that bar and they're watching bowling and there's this chick with like the tiny skirt and we're just staring at her ass while she's bowling? I'm like, what kind of bowling is this? There are certain times where you can see that grindhouse type effect that Eli Roth really enjoys within the film.
there's some pretty blatant sexualization there. But at the same time, there's also some really great dialogue with the radio announcer and stuff like that about the right and wrong of what he's doing. And this is the only place where they really talk about whether or not it's right or wrong is through the radio announcers. And there's one part there where they show them on screen where they're two black radio hosts.
Oh, was that the Sway in the Morning or something like that?
Yeah. But they ask, it's like, well, is it right that a white vigilante is shooting down two black criminals?
Right.
And it's a legitimate question.
Yeah, and they do that very carefully as to not give you an answer. They do leave that up to the audience within the film and outside of the film as well.
Yeah.
Because it is a moral dilemma and a moral question that you shouldn't give a concrete answer, at least within the body of the film.
No, because you're going to piss off somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, let's face it, you are going to piss off somebody.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little frustrating when, you know, you have that example in the film, but they don't mention the white criminals he's also shooting as well. I mean, that is a result of one particular incident, though.
That's right.
And that's, I think, right after he takes out the ice cream man.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. I actually believe the exact line of dialogue is, how do you support a white man shooting down a black criminal? It's a legitimate question and a great question. The question is, I mean, the question should have been, is how do you support vigilantism to begin with, right? Regardless of color or race. But I still think that Roth did a good job of bringing that in there, because it is actually a prevalent problem in the United States. Right? So it's his way, I think he was acknowledging that this is a problem in our country.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it kind of gets glossed over by the rest of the movie.
Yeah, because they don't really raise those other questions. I mean, at one point we got to think of, like, we have to think of like where the audience of Sway's show, especially after when he does that torture scene within the garage, and this guy's pinned under a car he's working on, and he's got his legs propped up, and this car kind of guillotine thing set up with the jack, and he's cutting the sciatic nerve and talking it through. Yeah, I've heard this is the most painful thing a human body can endure. And that shows you Eli Roth did his research, because that's something the Japanese actually did with their prisoners of war, is how much torture can the human body survive.
Yeah, and then he adds brake fluid to it.
Yeah, and then adds brake fluid to it. I mean, it's that kind of throws back to his torture porn days as well. It's like, oof, this is awfully excessive, but this is also one of the people responsible for the tragedy that's befallen his family.
Yeah, and I'll be honest with you, that scene of all of them was the one that made me most uncomfortable with his character.
Mm-hmm. Because like it does show you how far gone he's gone.
Yeah, because it took him into a dark place, and moves him from somebody that you can empathize with to somebody that you're like, I'm not sure that you've crossed a line now. There's a line that you've crossed that I'm not comfortable with.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's one of the things that diminishes this remake.
Yeah, and it does make you think that maybe there should be some consequences to his actions, because in both of these films, the cop figures it out and lets him get away, basically going, you need to get the fuck out of my city.
Yeah. Well, in the original, he's the union of the city, and then the remake, he says...
It's a little more metaphoric.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, it's like, you're done, right? There won't be any more...
The detective's brought to the crime scene back at the house where these thugs have trying to take Paul out once they found out what Paul's been doing. And Paul survives it, and he even bought some tactical furniture.
That was great. There's some great foreshadowing. I was just about to go there, because they foreshadow that by in the commercial, right?
It's
like, come and check out our tactical furniture, right?
I had to roll my eyes a little bit. I'm like, of course I knew that was coming back, but it was like... Yeah, I guess he would buy that.
Yeah.
So,
but I like the fact they didn't show you that he bought it. It was well set up, even though you knew it was coming.
Yeah. So there's talk about the guns in the house, and he's like, "Oh, well, I've got the bills of sale. Here's where I bought them." And he goes, "What about that other gun?"
Yeah. No. He says, "Did you ever get a Glock?" He says, "Oh yeah, I had one of those, but I don't have it anymore."
Yeah.
Right? It's just a subtle way of saying I'm done.
Yeah.
Right?
It is. It's a subtle way of saying he's done. And I've gotten rid of that. Good. That gun should stay gone.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and it was a really subtle way of ending it.
Yeah. So everybody knew, and everybody was like, okay, I know you know, and vice versa. Let's just call it a day. You're done. You're not doing this anymore.
Yeah. And I
do feel like, and it does. It leaves you in a weird place of like, you know, should he be paying for this? In some way.
Yeah, does he deserve a happy ending?
And they did struggle with this in the original film. Like, they had several endings with the Frank detective character at one point. They had it scripted. He finds Paul dead and then sees the gun and thinks about picking up where he left off. It was just one of many thoughts about how to end this movie.
Well, it's a tough ending, again, because, I mean, you empathize more with Paul in the original, than I did in the remake. The remake's a great action film, but it's one of the problems I have with most action films, the cliches of the everyman getting away with some pretty violent stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they walk away free and clear, and it's never really addressed. Right? I mean, they do kind of in this movie address it, at least that as to how he gets the happy ending. But with this particular movie, the question should be, did he deserve the happy ending?
Yeah, and again, that's, I guess, left up to the audience. Yeah. I mean, studios hoping it's going to do well so they can do another 15 billion Death Wishes. Obviously, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, clearly, yeah.
Clearly, and if they do, they're going to be recasting that part, I'm sure.
Yeah, in another 20, 30 years, they'll try again with somebody else, you know?
Yeah, probably. But I don't know. I feel these movies are kind of the same for different reasons, like as far as how I feel about them. I think I liked them about the same for different reasons.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a slower plottingness to the original, but I, like you, I liked the open-endedness of it, and that it was, there was no closure to the crime at the beginning of the movie. It's just this man driven into rage. And it's still there in the remake. I think, you know, I enjoyed the action sequences a little bit more than the more dramatic beats of the other film. So
exactly. They are, given that they're based on the same source material and they're and each other, well, not on each other because only one's based on the other. But but yeah, it's there are different movies because there's so much closure in the remake. I mean, he gets the bad guys who hurt his family, and that's one of the things that modern moviegoers really need is closure.
Yeah.
Right. And I'll count myself among them for the most part, but that in this particular case, I like that fact. I really enjoyed that fact about the original. It's like, because
I liked it, but it frustrated me at the same time. So I get it because I'm part of that audience who wants closure, but I do appreciate it when I don't get it. Cause I'm like, oh, that was bold.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it emphasized more the question of whether or not what he was doing was actually right.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was going after people who weren't involved in what happened to his family. And I mean, all the way through the movie. And they suggested that there was the hope that he would get them. But they never really outright said that, because who was he going to tell? Yeah. I think that they could have done that to great effect in this remake, now that I'm thinking about it. When they first start cluing in and they first investigate his brother, and they have that dialogue about, well, who else is going to do it? Right, and they could have set it up. It's like, well, I'm out there. I'm hoping I'm going to get these guys. I may not know it, but I hope I do.
Yeah.
Right? That would have really tied both movies really together really well. And then if it did, they kept going with the track that they've gone with this remake, where he does get that clue, then at least it would have kind of tied it back to that first one and filled in that hole that was in the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had that opportunity.
Yeah, they just didn't take it.
Yeah.
But overall, like, this was a movie I was not really looking forward to as far as the remake goes, because of my history of not liking Eli Roth films. But, you know, it's been a while. I can certainly see how far he's come as a director. I kind of appreciated some of the choices he made. There's certainly some holdovers from old Eli Roth in
there
as
well. And he's good at subtlety. I talked about One Other Day, when there's a horror called Knock Knock.
Right.
That is really subtle. I don't think there's any blood or gore in it at all.
No, he's definitely trying to kind of
Diversify
and shake off some of the stigma he had before. And maybe not really, because, I mean, he did do Green Inferno.
Which I haven't seen, so I have no judgment on that one yet.
Yeah.
But I like where I think I like where he's going as a director.
I like how he's developing. Yeah. He's got a long way to go to get to that Tarantino level where he's making good films out of bad genres.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, but he's getting there. I think he's getting there.
Yeah. Like I said, I love when he talks about movies, and I mean, he has a certain understanding of it, but his execution wasn't quite there 10 years ago, but I think he's getting there now.
I'd have to agree. Like I said, I quite enjoyed Knock Knock, even though in the end it's a pretty weak script, but he made it solid. And this, I'd say this is the same with this one as well. And given that this is his first actual remake.
Yeah. And I mean, he took a pretty basic concept and tried to add a few layers to it.
Yeah. And for the most part, I'd say successfully. Yeah.
Yeah. I think mixed success, but that mixed success comes from, I think, maybe some mixed performances as well.
I think so as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes you can lay that on the director, but sometimes you can just, if the talent just doesn't want to come out that day.
Yeah, it's like, I need a paycheck, but I don't want to do this.
Yeah. Like, initially, I was like, I'm not sure if Bruce Willis is the right guy for this. I'm still not entirely sure, but I think it worked. I mean, when you think of action stars that have hit their middle ages now,
well,
he's actually past his middle age.
Yeah,
now,
no. And I like the fact that he's still pulling off these types of roles.
Yeah.
Right. His character has changed in the sense that he's now playing the aging, the aging hero, which John Wayne did so well as well.
Yeah.
But I think that, unfortunately, there's also that stigma that Bruce Willis has for being difficult to work with that's keeping him from getting some of the better roles that he should be getting.
Yeah.
And I don't know what he actually is like on set. I know just this is all stuff I've heard from.
Yeah, we've definitely heard those stories over the years from different directors, and I haven't seen anything publicly said from Eli Roth's standpoint, who's very outspoken. Yeah. So maybe it went better on this one.
Well, and you know, and a lot of actors go through that phase where they're difficult. Yeah. Right. A lot of them do. It's a sad but true fact. Is sometimes your stardom goes to your head and you start acting like a
dick. And it does hurt their career for a little while. Yeah. We've kind of seen that career slump happen with several actors who were kind of hit it big for a while and then faded and then they have to rebuild. But every career has those ups and downs, and it's hard to stay on top.
Yeah, no, then they do. They cycle, right? But I think that Bruce still has some good stuff in him. I think that, I can't wait to talk about Glass at some point with somebody.
we'll get there at some point. Because that's like a good 20-year cycle there for three films to see how that develops. But
yeah, and I still haven't seen it.
I haven't either, but didn't do nearly as well as Split. So,
which is unfortunate. I think the director, Shyamalan, is hit or miss for a lot of people, right?
Yeah, he definitely went through his own slump. You can easily say he was actually, him and Tarantino certainly gave Bruce Willis a career bump.
Yes.
Around the same time, so.
They certainly did, yeah. I'd have to agree with you on that one.
All right, any last thoughts about Death Wish?
I think that people should give both these movies the credit they're due.
Yeah, I think so. I think they're decent. In the end, they're not. It's not high art here.
It's not. But you should think while you're watching them because there is something to think about while you're watching
them. There is a message there that I think audiences might struggle with. Yeah. That's not always a bad thing.
No, you're going to take. You need to take away whatever you're going to take away from it. But
yeah, just don't go out there and shooting people randomly because that would be the wrong message.
That would. Yes.
We got one more thought here, though. Last week we teased a new segment that has already been retitled on me because apparently the V card was a little too icky for Val.
Yeah.
Sam's wife is known to be a bit outspoken, so I thought, hey, it would be fun to give her own segment and just let her fly for a minute or two about the movies we cover because she has trouble doing an hour and a half like us. She just wants to watch the movie.
Yeah.
And she might only have a couple things to say about it. So we're debuting a new segment here called V-Trigger. Sorry.
For Kevin. Now.
For now. If you got a better title, please let us know in the comments and we might change the name of the title. Who knows? It might get a new title every week.
it could very well. Now, I will say one thing because she doesn't mention it in her bit. But she only watched the first one. She couldn't bring herself to watch the second one.
Cool. That makes me just want to listen to this even more. So here it is, the debut segment, V-Trigger?
This week's movie, Charles Bronson and Death Wish. Architect by day, vigilante by night. More like just a murderer out on a murder spree. I mean, Charles Bronson was out looking for the three dudes that killed his wife. And so he just gets out there and he starts plugging thugs in hopes that he gets, like, you know, hits the right one. Fails miserably, completely loses the plot. I mean, it's ridiculous. This has to be the most ridiculous movie I've ever seen. So he never does end up finding the dudes that killed his wife. And, you know, I was pretty much done with the movie by the time he repainted his walls the ugliest fucking color known to man. But I kept watching because I kept hoping that he was actually going to get the guys. And nope, he doesn't. Anyway, I'm done with this movie. Don't ever make me watch it again. And I rate it. I want my hour and 33 minutes back.
Okay, that was the V trigger. God love her.
Yeah, I will say that it was fun to. She made me go away while she recorded it. And I showed her how to use the equipment, and then she
went. That's excellent, because it was a surprise to you as well. Then.
But yeah, and then, of course, when I did have to add some stuff to it, because there's some fun stuff happening there. But but yeah, I'm listening to it, and as soon as I was done, I'm like, that was perfect. Thank you. As I'm laughing.
Well, you know, we were sitting at a podcaster meeting, and then she said that stuff to me about, you know, you guys go on and on about a movie. I'm like, I just want to watch the damn thing. I'm like, it's that outspokenness. I'm like, how about I give you 60 seconds to do that every week? Cause I'm really enjoying it right now.
Yeah. And now you get your Val fix every week.
That's right. Somehow she managed to get on every episode from here going forward.
Yes.
Or if she wants to do them.
Yeah, we'll see how she feels about doing it weekly. I mean, this is our first week, and
it's going to be at least a semi regular feature.
Yes, yeah. I'll tell you, she did have fun doing it.
That's great.
Yeah, I mean, you can tell just by her delivery, but yeah, I'm looking forward to editing more of those and seeing Jay's reaction to them, and hopefully yours as well.
Well, if you like that new segment, let us know on our social media at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion of the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and Invasion of the Remake at gmail.com. Send us your questions, suggestions, and comments as well, and your fan challenges. We do have one coming up, and actually, I'll run the audio for that next week to set it up. Because there's still a lot of options within the fan challenge, but we got an audio submission from What Does It Matter podcast, and I think we'll have Sean on to do it with us.
If he's available, we want him in there, yeah.
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 But sure. I'll run that audio next week so we can tease that for you.
Yes. As Sean said to me after listening to the episode, he goes, challenge accepted. He'd already recorded it and sent it to JJ. I actually knew the challenge had been accepted before I did. Yeah, so yeah, that was you're welcome to do it too.
Yes, if you've got a microphone and the recording equipment, just send us the recording. That's another way you can get yourself on the show.
Use your phone
and send us the record, email us that recording, and we'll air the challenge and maybe do it.
Maybe. But do not challenge us to the thing, because we're not going to do it.
No, don't challenge us to the thing. We're saving that for a special episodes, so don't worry, it's coming. Stop asking. Well, no, you can keep asking. Ask all you want. We'll do it when we do it.
Yeah, we just haven't determined what the special occasion is yet.
No, it'll happen. But, you know, you don't do the best remake ever right out of the gate.
No.
That's just blowing your wad too early.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know if it's the best remake ever, but it's definitely okay. It's the best remake ever.
There you go. All right. We also got a new sponsor this week.
Is it a sponsor or partnership? I think it's a partnership, yeah.
A new partnership. And, you know, as a Calgarian, I'm really into the playoffs right now. Calgary, as of this recording, is tied 1-1 in the playoff round with the Colorado Avalanche. And I'm really hoping they'll do it. I'm really hoping they'll make it. But by the time you hear this, it'll be 2 weeks, and then probably the round will be over, so I have no idea. But if you want to get to a playoff game, watch an NHL playoff game. Tickets can be ridiculously priced sometimes, but you go over to SeatGiant. If you're American, SeatGiant.com. If you're Canadian, SeatGiant.ca. And the .com's in U.S. dollars. The .ca is in Canadian dollars. And they can be up to 70% off other ticket sites. And with our promo code, even more. If you use the promo code at checkout on your ticket purchases at SeatGiant, use this promo code INVASION, and you'll get an additional discount on your purchase. And you'll help out the show by doing so. And come on. What better deal is that? And if you're not a sports fan, they got other stuff there as well. I was looking up May 28th. Shares coming to town here in Calgary. Big ticket sales there. Godsmack, man.
Yeah. Theater tickets. You want to see Phantom? Is it still running? I don't know. Who cares? Cats. Right? But if you want to go to the theater, SeatGiant. SeatGiant. No, seriously.
SeatGiant.
Yeah.
They're a game changer. All right. Another way you can help out the show, again, you can use that promo code INVASION over at SeatGiant, but you can also leave us a rating and a short review over on iTunes, and tell everybody where to find the show. Of course, we're on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play Music, TuneIn Radio, Player FM, Radio Public, and even frickin' YouTube. Make sure you tell your friends and family where to find the show, and help the invasion grow. Get your earballs on the show.
And maybe your voice challenge us.
Yes, and maybe your voice. So keep in mind, we'll take those challenges. That was Death Wish. Yeah, not bad. I mean, I'm still not sold on Charles Bronson, to be honest.
I'm with you there.
But I'm sure we'll cover more.
Possibly, maybe.
Maybe. What's your favorite Charles Bronson film? Let us know. I've been Jason.
I'm always Sam.
And we are out of here.
So you're saying you got both the cut in your hand that's almost healed and the shot in the shoulder tonight? That's your story?
That's what happened. It's my story.
Hmm. And the paperwork for the pistols and the rifle?
You can call Jolly Roger Sporting Goods. Ask for Bethany.
And you bought these guns?
The day my daughter came home. Just in case something like this ever happened again.
What about a Glock?
I had one for a while. I decided to get rid of it.
Gone for good?
Yeah, gone for good.
Well, I got everything I need. Seems pretty straightforward. Knox came back because he thought Jordan could ID him, and he defended your family like any man would.
Thank you.
And Dr. Kersey, stick to saving lives. You're good at it.
I will. Thanks for everything.